From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Some Republicans are trying to prevent OSHA from collecting data on repetitive stress-related injuries in the workplace. We'll have a debate on workers' compensation. And every time you surf the net, you leave clues about your identity for corporations to exploit. We'll discuss privacy and access. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Blaming cheap cigarettes and nicotine's powerful hold, the government acknowledged it won't be able to meet its goal of reducing smoking to 15% of adults by the year 2000. A national survey by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that smoking among American adults rose to 25% in 94, up from 25% the previous year. The percentage has held steady at around 25% during the 90s, after dropping from 42% from 65 to 90. And Republicans have a new strategy for countering Buttman, the human cigarette who's been showing up at Bob Dole events. They've started sending in their own activists to poke fun at him. Democratic demonstrators dressed as giant cigarettes have been dogging the Republican presidential contender ever since Dole's controversial suggestion last month that smoking wasn't necessarily addictive. So it was nothing new to see a Buttman along with about a dozen demonstrators with Clinton Gore signs outside a plant on Wednesday where Dole was giving a speech. The new twist, standing on either side of Buttman, were two individuals holding signs. One said, "Clinton's next national security advisor," with an arrow pointing toward Buttman. The other, with an arrow pointing at him from the other side, said, "The next Craig Livingstone," referring to the former Clinton White House security chief whose collection of FBI files on Republicans is the center of new inquiries in Washington. And Bob Dole suggests he wouldn't have been welcome at the NAACP meeting. The Republican presidential candidate has taken criticism for not speaking at the group's annual convention. Dole said his aides turned down the invitation because of a scheduling conflict. However, he also said that if he had gone, he wouldn't have gotten an enthusiastic reception. Dole said it's a liberal group headed by former Congressmember Kwesi Mfume. Dole called him a leading liberal Democrat. And taking full advantage of recently relaxed campaign laws, President Clinton is spending millions of dollars in contributions and tax dollars earmarked for the primaries on ads, polling, and opposition research aimed at Bob Dole. While Dole limps along this summer with just a pittance of his legally limited funds left from the heated Republican primaries, the president has about $17 million left in the bank and is well positioned to stage a television advertising blitz before the fall campaign officially starts. And his role at next month's Republican convention still unclear, Pat Buchanan is refusing to attend a GOP unity luncheon featuring Bob Dole and his presidential primary rivals. Buchanan, who is in a war of nerves with the Dole campaign over a convention role, has not formally ended his campaign for the Republican nomination or endorsed Dole. Given that, he said, "I do not feel free to accept your invitation at this time." Seven other Dole rivals have accepted invitations to the Tuesday meeting in Washington. Dole aides said it was unclear if Dole would discuss possible convention roles for the men he defeated in the Republican presidential primaries. You're listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday, the House of Representatives stripped a rider on an appropriations bill that would stop OSHA from setting guidelines or collecting data on hundreds of thousands of repetitive stress-related injuries that occur in the workplace each year. While Labor has won that victory, it's not breathing a sigh of relief just yet, because the two Texas Republicans who introduced it, Henry Bonilla and Tom DeLay — DeLay owned a pesticide company before becoming a congressmember — vow that they will force its reconsideration. Joining us to talk about what is called the Ergo Rider is Peg Seminario. She's head of occupational safety and health at the AFL-CIO in Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Peg.
Good morning.
Well, why don't you tell us what's happening, since it seems that things are changing by the minute in Congress right now?
Well, basically what has happened is that the Republicans had been successful at the committee level in inserting a provision in the funding bill for OSHA, the job safety agency, which would prohibit the agency from issuing a standard, issuing voluntary guidelines, or even from collecting information on problems of repetitive strain injuries and other ergonomic problems in the workplace. So that prohibition was in the bill, and yesterday the House acted on the bill, and there was an amendment proposed by Congresswoman Pelosi of California to take that out, strip it out of the bill, and that amendment was successful. And then last night the final bill was passed by the House of Representatives, So that prohibition on OSHA is no longer in the bill.
So isn't that a victory for labor?
It's a very major victory. We have been fighting tooth and nail with the employers on this issue for a couple of years with respect to ergonomic injuries and illnesses. This is a huge workplace problem. When you look at the injury and illness statistics, what you see is that one-third of all serious workplace injuries are caused either by repetitive motion or overexertion from keyboard operators, poultry workers, people that work in parcel delivery, heavy lifting of packages. We have more than 700,000 workers every year suffering serious injuries as a result of these hazards. So clearly it's a major hazard that needs to be addressed. And what Congressman Bonilla and Congressman DeLay were saying is that we shouldn't even collect data. We shouldn't even study this very, very serious problem.
Is it possible they will get this reintroduced?
What is the next step in this process is that the Senate will take up the bill. The Senate in the past has not wanted to include this kind of language, and it's always been the House insisting on it. But what we don't know is what will happen with the final funding measures this year. We all know we went through last year with the budget, with the government shutdowns and the budget process, and this year we may end up with the government being funded through what's called a continuing resolution. That means we continue what's going on right now and this year's funding and bring it forward. We are now living under a prohibition on OSHA issuing guidelines and standards on ergonomics. That's in effect. It's been in effect from last year, and it lapses on September 30th. And so if there is a continuation of the current situation, we may be in a position where OSHA can continue to work on the problem, collect data, but because of the existing prohibition, won't be able to issue a standard or wouldn't even be able to issue voluntary guidelines. So we still have a ways to go to get out of the situation that we're now in, where the agency can't even act to issue voluntary guidelines. So there's still a ways to go here.
Peg Seminario, what about the recent Supreme Court decision in Virginia on carpal tunnel syndrome?
In Virginia, under the state workers' compensation law, there has been there's been a question for some time now as to whether or not it covers carpal tunnel syndrome. That's because in Virginia and some other states, what you have is a statute that was written to compensate people generally for injuries. And as we have diseases or other conditions that happen over time, how you deal with these chronic diseases or these chronic conditions is less clear. What happened in Virginia was that carpal tunnel was ruled a disease and not an injury because it occurs over time. And to be compensated for a disease in Virginia, it has to be in the law on a list. And it's not on the list in the Virginia comp law. And so the Virginia Supreme Court ruled that even though this might be a serious problem, it was not compensable under Virginia state law. And the legislature in Virginia took up the issue just before it left for the year earlier this spring and decided not to compensate workers for this serious problem. So right now, if you live in the state of Virginia, you work in the state of Virginia, you develop carpal tunnel syndrome, there is no compensation for you. There is no payment of your medical care related to these disorders in the state of Virginia.
We're going to be talking about carpal tunnel syndrome in just a minute with a woman who has carpal tunnel. She's an injured worker here in New York. But before we do that, we're also joined by Greg Tarpinian, who's head of Labor Research Associates here in New York. Greg, this week saw several critical victories for workers in the labor movement in what has been billed as the most anti-worker Congress in history. Congress passed a 90-cent increase in the minimum wage, voted down a so-called national right to work law, and passed by a much closer margin than expected the TEAM Act, which would have allowed a return to the kind of employer-dominated company union that has been banned by the national labor laws since 1935. President Clinton vows to veto it. Can you tell us briefly about the significance of these bills?
Well, excuse me, all three of those bills would have undermined worker rights in the workplace. And what we see now is a situation where the labor movement is going directly to the voters and showing that it still has some political clout. And that's what's revealed in those three things that you described.
The TEAM Act in particular, now this was a victory actually for management in Congress, and yet it looks like Clinton is going to be vetoing it.
Well, it's a victory for management, but they don't have enough votes to override a veto. And that's really the issue here. The TEAM Act, it's interesting that it passed as slimly as it did. Because it, on the face of it, it appears to be like motherhood and apple pie. I mean, we want to get workers and management to cooperate. That was the whole spin on the TEAM Act. But in reality, what it does is it allows management to bring company unions into the workplace.
Well, I want to thank Peg Seminario. I know you have to be leaving, who is head of the Occupational Safety and Health at the AFL-CIO in Washington. Greg, you'll be staying with us. Today, we're broadcasting out of New York, where it looks like the state legislature has finally agreed on a budget and is expected to vote on it today. It's the latest budget in state history, despite the fact that the Republican governor, George Pataki, had attacked the former governor, Democrat Mario Cuomo, continually during the campaign for late budgets. One of the major obstacles to the budget was the battle over worker compensation, a conflict that has been battled out in states around the country. And we're joined by three people to debate the issue. We've got Greg Tarpini in the studio. Again, he heads up Labor Research Associates. David Schaefer is on the phone with us. He's director of the Public Policy Institute of the New York State Business Council. And we've got Monica Brown, who is an injured worker and part of a group called Injured Workers of New York. And joining me to discuss this issue is my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Juan Gonzalez is a columnist with the Daily News.
Good morning, Amy. And I'd like to ask first, Greg, there apparently was a final agreement after many months of battling over this issue at the state level in the last couple of days. From your perspective, what is the agreement? Well, first, what is the problem that that the two sides were battling over in terms of workmen's compensation?
Well, I'm sure Mr. Schaefer will talk about why the Business Council wanted to gut the workers' compensation system in New York. But that's been the agenda.
Go ahead.
That's been the agenda of the Business Council and other business lobbyist forces in New York State for some time now.
It has not and is not.
Well, Mr. Schaefer, we'll let Greg put out his perspective, and then we'll get your viewpoint.
I'd be interested in hearing his viewpoint. I'm not interested in having him characterize my viewpoint.
Okay. I won't characterize anymore. Let me just say this, though, that there has been a fight, and up until about a week ago, it appeared as though the Assembly and the Senate would not get together on workers' compensation, and that a budget would be passed, and there would be no change in workers' comp. The Assembly had a bill, the Senate had a bill. As of about a week ago, however, Governor Pataki attached a resolution of the budget to some form of reform, in his words, of workers' compensation. So a deal apparently has been struck. All the fine details I have not seen. I'm not in Albany. But the essential big compromise that the Assembly made was on something called Dole versus Dow, which allowed workers who sued a manufacturer of a piece of equipment that may have injured them, allowed that manufacturer to bring the employer into the suit if the employer was in any way responsible for the misuse of the equipment or the chemical or what have you.
But isn't from the business community's perspective, wasn't the whole aim of the workers' compensation system to provide an insurance system for workers so that you would not have suits arising from injuries, but that the system itself would compensate workers, so that in essence the business community is saying that this particular third-party avenue was in essence circumventing the original aim of workers' compensation.
Yeah, that's their position.
Yeah, Mr. Schaefer, could you tell us what from the perspective of the business community, what is wrong with the workers' compensation system in New York State?
Well, we think that the system is too expensive and doesn't work effectively for employers or workers. It takes too long to get benefits resolved. There are too many opportunities for people extraneous to the system to try to make a living off of it, including doctors and healthcare providers. And too much of the money that's in it goes to people who are not the intended beneficiaries. That's our core problem with it. And you're right, Juan, that one critical issue is it's supposed to be a no-fault system, where if you're injured on the job, you get compensated. Whether it's your fault, the employer's fault, or an act of nature, you get help. It's not supposed to be a system where everybody runs to court and sues everybody else, and the lawyers go home with the money.
But in terms, then, of the compromise that was reached in the last couple of days, are you clear on what are the main contours of that compromise?
We are not completely clear. What we know is that in place of the existing court decision, which basically holds that you can have an open-ended access to court if you're an injured, if you're a manufacturer of a product about which an injured worker has sued, the manufacturer of that product can go back and sue the employer without restraint. That's been the existing court precedent. The compromise will roll that back dramatically. The Trial Lawyers Association, which says this will eliminate about 9 out of 10 of the cases that can be brought now, and it's going to be limited to the most serious ones involving death or dismemberment.
You know, I should point out that workers will still be able to sue the manufacturers, but the manufacturer will not be able to bring the employer into the suit.
That's correct, and that's an important point. If a worker is injured because a ladder is a defective piece of equipment or something like that, they're still going to have the right to sue. What we would like to see, to be honest about it, is that there not be these kinds of injuries. The most important thing is to use the system to try to improve safety in the workplace in the interest of both parties involved, the employees and the employers.
But David Schaefer, let me just ask a quick question. Let's say the manufacturer has a safety guard on the equipment and the employer takes it off to speed up production. Can the worker sue the employer?
Well, under the bill, depending upon the kind of injury, the answer is no. But under the bill also, the penalties, including criminal penalties, for employers who cause problems in the workplace will be increased. And from my point of view, that's the most important thing. People talk about the Dole v. Dow problem as though this is a thing that has somehow made the workplace safe. Actually, what the cases demonstrate is it hasn't had the effect of deterring unsafe conditions in the workplace, because the sanctions are purely random. They rest on the whims of the trial bar and the civil litigation system. The statute that the legislature is going to pass is going to significantly increase the sanctions for employers who maintain unsafe workplaces, whether somebody sues them or not.
What about the issue of that New York State, on the one hand, has one of the most expensive workman's compensation systems in terms of premiums, but on the other hand, the payouts to injured workers are among the lowest of states.
Well, that's another
of
the problems. I said 1-1 is a system that's more cost-effective for both sides, and unfortunately what has happened in Albany is that the issue has gotten tied up around the interests of the people who live off the system, including the providers and the lawyers, and the interests of the employers and the workers were hard to bring to the fore in that environment. And the Business Council supported a bill that would have increased maximum weekly benefits.
Well, that's
and that's not being done in the course of this compromise agreement that came forth, because so much of the time and attention and political argument was focused on the needs and interests of the trial lawyers rather than the workers.
Well, I think that's a misrepresentation from the standpoint that increasing the maximum weekly benefit would affect about 3% of the claimants, so that you could increase it to $1,000 a week. Most workers would not benefit. The reality is that the Business Council attempted also to they backed legislation that would have brought AMA guidelines into the determination of disability. That would have taken
the American Medical Association guidelines.
That would have taken, they claim, about $900 million, would have saved them about $900 million. It would have also dramatically reduced benefits for workers. So I think Mr. Schaefer is being slightly disingenuous in suggesting that the Business Council was there fighting for the general welfare of employers and workers against the greedy trial bar.
Greg Tarpinian, is the issue that's going on, the struggle over workers' compensation in New York State, is this typical of what is going on around the country?
Yeah, it is. It's going on in nearly every state in the country in one form or another. New York, from the national business community's position, has been slow to reform. And that's because of the strength of the labor movement in this state, which has been significant. I think business and labor both agree that the system is in dire straits. The issue is, how do you solve the problem? What we've tried to point out is that while the system is expensive, the workers aren't really getting the benefit. And we've also pointed out that we need to really look at how the money is distributed in the system, particularly the role of the insurance companies in the system.
We're going to talk about the role of the insurance companies, but first we're going to be hearing from Monica Brown, who is an injured worker herself, and she'll talk about what happened to her when she applied originally for workers' compensation. And I guess in her case, the question is, who pays? The business where she got hurt, or the people of the United States in the form of welfare? We're going to hear from her in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, the program that dares to ask the questions the corporate media won't. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting out of New York today. I'm joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez, and we've got three people with us this morning. We're joined by David Schaefer, who's the director of the Public Policy Institute of the Business Council of New York State. We're also joined by Greg Tarpinian, who heads up the Labor Research Associates here in New York. And we're now going to turn to Monica Brown, who is an injured worker. Monica, tell us what happened to you.
Amy, I was a word processor and I was a temporary. I worked at several of the major security firms and accounting firms in the city. I began to develop carpal tunnel. Actually, I did not know what carpal tunnel was. I began to lose feeling and have burning sensation in my hand. When I went to my employer and told her that I was having trouble with my hands, publicly she laughed in my face. Privately, she suggested that I apply for public assistance. It took approximately 1.5 years from the time I applied for workers' comp to actually receive a notice of decision in my case. During that first year and a half, I received no benefits, no compensation, no therapy.
But you did receive welfare?
I had no choice. I had no income coming in, so I had to, I guess maybe about 6 to 9 months into it, I had used all my savings. Friends had helped me as much as they could. I had to turn to the welfare system, yes.
Well, let me ask, because I've interviewed many workers who have encountered similar delays, long delays in the workman's compensation of application and awarding process. Mr. Schaefer, can you tell us what, from your perspective, some of the problems are, why it takes so long for a worker, an injured worker, to be able to get some kind of a benefit adjustment?
Well, I wish I knew. There are two basic reasons, bureaucracy and contention. And both of them are big problems, and we want them fixed. And we want them fixed for two reasons, one of which is most employers are genuinely concerned about their workers. But the other is that the kinds of cases that Monica is talking about are a big problem and a cost problem for employers, because when workers go in and run into these lengthy delays in trying to get their case handled and resolved, they end up hiring lawyers. Because they think that's the only way they can get what they're entitled to. And then that ends up getting more contention and more cost into the system. So we strongly want a system that works faster and gets these controversial cases resolved quickly.
Mr. Schaefer,
Monica, in your case, did you hire a lawyer? Or?
I had no choice.
Right. A lot of people have no choice.
In the workers' compensation system, you have no choice. If you do not hire a lawyer, then you may not get your benefits at all. From a worker's point of view, your lawyer fights for your rights. Otherwise, you are ignored or just eaten up by the system.
Greg Tarpinian, what do you see as some of the reasons for these long delays?
Well, it is contentious. It's a struggle. And employers aren't sitting back saying, geez, we'll help you out. I mean, the reality is they fight it every step of the way. If there are injuries on the job and an unsafe workplace, premiums rise. So it's in the interest of employers to fight the claims that workers like Monica make. I mean, the horror show, if there were not lawyers, I mean, it's nice to say we should get the lawyers out of the system, and that makes good popular appeal, as it were. But the reality is that without the lawyers, the workers are outgunned. The employers have the lawyers, the insurance companies have the lawyers, and everybody else in the system is fighting to make sure a poor worker like Monica, who's probably not making more than $300 or $400 a week, ends up living on $100 or less a week.
Let me ask one question in terms of this issue of the lawyers. Hasn't one thing that Governor Pataki has begun to institute actually created the greater possibility of more lawyers, because he moved to eliminate the workman's compensation doctors who, in as I understand it, if a worker is injured, usually he or she goes to a doctor who certifies their illness. The insurance company gets another doctor who usually certifies that the illness is not as bad as the worker claims. And then the workman's compensation doctors, the state doctors, were in essence the third party, the neutral party that made a judgment. And the governor, by moving to eliminate workman's compensation doctors, would now, in essence, be leaving no other alternative but a continued legal battle between the injured worker. Mr. Schaefer, is that accurate or not, or do you have another perspective on that?
I'll tell you a little story about the system that does involve the doctors that may give some perspective on this. From my point of view, the bottom line here is that the system is so cumbersome, difficult, and hard to use that it inspires both parties to bring in lawyers and get into fights when they would not need to do that on either side if the bureaucratic process worked more effectively. Now, I've denounced lawyers. I'll also tell you, some of my best friends are lawyers. And there's a lawyer who's a tenant in the same building that we're in who told me an interesting story the other day. 82-year-old man works part-time as a handyman at a church in Albany, of which he is a member. Church pays him $80 a week. He gives $80 a week back to the church as a contribution. What he gets out of it is he gets to be in their health insurance plan. That's why he does it, plus the fact that he wants to help out around the church. He cut his hand installing a window, gave himself first aid in the church office. They had a first aid kit, came back the next day, went back to work, no big deal. Somebody in the church office said, you know, we're supposed to file a report on this to the workers' comp board. They filed the report to the workers' comp board, and 5 months later, this 82-year-old man gets a notice telling him he's got to come in for a hearing. He thinks he's done something wrong. He doesn't remember the incident at this point. He goes in, gets interviewed, fills out some forms, talks to one of the doctors. The doctor notices that he has stiff knees. He has a hard time walking. He says, is this a result of this injury? He says, no, of course not. I cut my hand. They go back and forth. The doctor says, this has got to be, you know, this is work-related. And the guy says, I'm 82 years old. My knees have hurt for 30 years. It's not work-related. He ends up telling him that he's going to give him $79 a week. Don't ask me how they came up with that number. $79 a week for this knee injury as a permanent partial disability.
Greg Tarpinian, is this a typical story?
It's one of the most bizarre stories I've ever heard, it's obviously one of the anecdotes that the Business Council trots out whenever they want to show how.
I've never trotted it out before. And what I'm telling you about this, however, is that this kind of thing, employers think this kind of thing is going to happen to them, they hire a lawyer. Employees think that they're going to get a runaround like Monica Brown had, so they hire a lawyer.
Well, let me go back to Monica Brown for a minute. Monica, you told us the story of what happened to you. You got hurt. You got carpal tunnel syndrome, your year-and-a-half battle until you got workers' comp forcing you onto welfare. What happened after that year and a half? I mean, have you been cured?
Oh, no. I began to receive physical therapy. However, with the physical therapy, you have to go back to your employer every 4 weeks to get approval to continue therapy. Sometimes the approval process would take 4 to 6 to 8 weeks. So when I would begin therapy again, it was like beginning from the beginning. Therapy never worked for me. I am now recovering from my fourth surgery. I had surgeries on both hands and both elbows. But Amy, there's something that I'd like to say. Carpal tunnel is the type of injury like in Virginia, where they do not recognize it, you have a very difficult time establishing your case here in New York, too. Most carpal tunnel cases are immediately controverted. You have no choice but to fight. No matter how hurt you are, you have no choice and you must get a lawyer.
Would you have had to have these surgeries if you had started therapy from the day you realized that you had carpal tunnel?
No, and that's the thing. It would have saved the employer money. I would have returned to work right by now. I probably would have never went on welfare. All around, if you treat the injured employee as soon as the injury occurs, everyone saves money, from the employer to the employee to the doctors, the lawyers. Everything saves money.
Greg Tarpino, I want to ask about the people who actually take in the premiums and pay out the claims in workman's compensation, the insurance companies. What is their role in terms of the issue of cost, or is there any in terms of how, for instance, in some states like New York State, the cost to employers of the premiums is so high?
Well, I mean, I think it's a general problem. What we've tried to suggest, or at least the AFL-CIO has tried to suggest, is that we should take a look at the money in the system. Where does it go? Who gets it? How much of it stays in the coffers of the insurance companies? One big thing that hasn't really been discussed is the State Insurance Fund of New York State, which insures most small employers. The state government has periodically raided that fund to subsidize budget deficits. So there's a lot of money in the system. There's a lot of ways to squeeze money out, and it would be nice if the way that the business council went about it was not to try and undermine workplace safety standards or to undermine the ability of workers to get adequate benefits, and rather would work with us to look at where the money is in the system.
Well, there is nothing we've done to try to undermine workplace safety, in my view. The bill that we supported, that the governor introduced, would increase the sanctions for employers who maintain unsafe workplaces. And that is a priority of the business community, it has been for years, for a simple commercial reason. The businesses that cheat, that operate unsafe workplaces, can undercut the prices of the competitors who do an honest job. So it's very important for us to crack down on that kind of activity.
Well, what about the insurance companies? Do you feel that
everybody wants to blame them. They're the people you pay the money to, and where everybody wonders where all the money goes. Facts are, if you look at the numbers, commercial carriers in New York on workers' comp appear to be slightly less profitable than the national average. Well, most of the business in the state, the largest carrier in the state, is a state-operated not-for-profit, the State Insurance Fund that Greg referred to. So you can't say it's profits that's doing
well,
this.
The state
the insurance carriers have a special problem in New York because two aspects of the system are unpredictable. Insurance works best when you can make a reasonably good guess as to what your losses will be. And on most kinds of property and casualty insurance, and this is in that category, you can do that. You know how many traffic accidents there are going to be a year. You can do a reasonably good job pricing an auto insurance policy. Workers' comp, on the straight claims basis, is also pretty predictable. There's not a lot of variation from year to year. What makes the system in New York chaotic is that we've got a couple of elements that are completely unpredictable, one of which was Dole v. Dow, and that's why we wanted to get rid of it. That's a thing that's hard for insurance companies to price accurately because they have no idea what individual juries are going to do in a given year. The second thing was the schedule. I think Greg referred to the AMA guidelines. There is right now, there are no guidelines for what you pay out in terms of long-term injury cases. They're erratic, hence they're unpredictable, hence insurance companies have a hard time pricing them accurately, and that tends to drive up rates higher than they need to be.
Let me bring Greg in here.
Well, you know, again, the business council wanted to cap permanent partial. They wanted to put a cap.
What's permanent partial for those?
They wanted to put a cap on the length of time that you could collect benefits if you are injured on a permanent basis.
Monica, how long have you been receiving now workers' compensation?
I've been receiving workers' compensation for approximately a year and a half. This is going into my third year of being in the system. I began in the system in 92,
and I should be concluded sometime shortly now that I've had the surgery.
Can you work? Do you think you'll be able to go back to work?
I will never be able to return to work as a word processor. I will have to be retrained for a whole new field.
Greg Tarpinian, let me ask you something. It was in the papers a few months ago, the story of a woman in New York who was severely hurt. And this is a story that you and labor unions in the state have made very well known by putting out, doing an ad campaign. Can you describe the story and how this woman's case came to light?
Well, you're referring to the case of Alice Hayes, who was a woman who had both of her arms basically cut off by a machine in her workplace up to her elbow.
How old is she?
She's in her 60s now. She was making about $6 an hour. She had been a 17-year employee of a plastics firm in Newburgh, New York. The reason the case came to our attention was because the CEO of that firm testified at a Senate hearing. And in that testimony, she decried the extraordinary expense of compensation and the premiums that she's had to pay, and that her premiums have risen because of a strange case, this case of Alice Hayes, it turns out, who was awarded ultimately $3 million. Alice Hayes was awarded $3 million. She brought suit against the manufacturer of the machine. The manufacturer of the machine then brought Newburgh Plastics into the suit in this Dole situation.
And Newburgh Plastics was her employer?
Was her employer. Mm-hmm. And it was determined, there was a settlement out of court, that Newburgh was 95% responsible. Not the machine manufacturer, but the employer was 95% responsible for her injuries. Why? Because her employer, in an effort to speed up production, had removed safety locks, had never trained the worker on the machine adequately, and so on and so forth down the line. Now, let's talk about lawyers. Newburgh Plastics insurance carrier tried to fight like hell on her original compensation claim. She was awarded $171 per week. All right, this is a woman whose arms were cut off up to the elbow. The insurance carrier argued that she was not as disabled as the workers' comp judge ultimately determined, because if she had put prosthesis on her arms, she could work. They claimed that she should be getting at most $47 a week. So it's not just these greedy lawyers out there to rip money out of the system for workers. On the other side of it, what we have is insurance companies who fight tooth and nail to keep workers from getting an adequate benefit.
Dave Schaefer,
which I think they do in part because they think that decisions will be made on an irrational basis against them, and that's what I'm arguing. The whole system is too contentious. I'd make a couple points about that one, if I might.
Yeah, sure.
That case, one of the things about that case, that is a tragic case, and there are others like that. And those are all things that happened under the system we have in New York, and it's odd for me to hear people who want to keep the system as it is cite those as examples of what a great system we have. To me, those are examples of why we have to change.
Well, she received...
You made the point, Juan, that the system is supposed to be no fault, and that is a very important fact about workers' comp that needs to be reemphasized. Many, if not most, accidents and injuries in the workplace are not the fault of the employer. Sometimes they're the fault of the employee. Sometimes they're just dumb accidents that nobody could prevent. Sometimes there's a mixture. Most of them, you could argue all day about them, whose fault they are. The reason workers' comp was created was so you don't have those arguments. Whatever the reason somebody's injured, if they're injured and they can't work, then they need to be taken care of. So we have workers' comp insurance to do that.
You know, it seems interesting to me, David Schaefer, as Juan pointed out at the beginning, that workers' comp was really set up to protect business so that workers wouldn't sue. And
no,
now business is fighting workers' compensation.
I'm sorry, I do not think that is correct. In the situation I described, most of these things, many or if not most cases, are not the fault of the employer. So providing a system
the business council opposed Dole. All right, they want to get rid of Dole v. Dow. The reality is that
Dole
did not protect Alice Hayes.
Dole protected Alice Hayes.
She got money, but she did not avoid her injury.
No, she did not.
And her lawyer got
she did not, but eliminating it will remove, will further undermine the incentives that employers have to create a safe workplace.
Well, I don't think that. I think that under the bill that the legislature is going to pass, the sanctions on employers that operates unsafe workplaces, whether somebody manages to sue them or not, will be increased.
David Schaefer, we're going to have to wrap up now, but I just want to ask Greg Tarpinian, do you see what happened in New York is happening all over the country right now? Is this a trend that workers' compensation is going to be attacked or already has been?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is a big cost to business, and like cutting taxes, business went through the tax cut routine. Now they're going to try and cut compensation premiums because it's effectively a tax on business.
And Monica Brown, I'm going to give you the last word right now as you hear this discussion on workers' compensation. How are you feeling?
I agree that reform is needed. However, I think that the business side is using anecdotes and they're putting out a false picture of what's really going on in the workplace. It's a little bit too rosy.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. Monica Brown, an injured worker who has carpal tunnel syndrome, David Schaefer, Director of Public Policy Institute at the Business Council of New York State, and Greg Tarpinian with Labor Research Associates here in New York City. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to be talking about the Internet, privacy, and access. Stay with us.
I'm Jan Laurie Goldman. Can you hear me okay? Let's assume they can hear me. Does that sound like a good volume?
You're listening to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in New York. My co-host Juan Gonzalez is still with us. This week, the American Library Association held its annual meeting here in New York. One of the many issues raised was libraries bringing equity to the Internet by providing free Internet access to underserved communities. For example, according to the latest Emerge magazine, only 12% of African American households own computers, compared with 30% of white households. And of African Americans with computers, more than half are without modems, the device that allows information to pass over telephone lines and link up with the Internet. Today, we're going to talk about access to the net, but then once you're hooked, how you can protect your privacy. Joining us from Chicago is Molly Callender of the American Library Association, and from Washington, Jan Laurie Goldman of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Molly Callender of the American Library Association, let's begin with you. You just finished your meeting here in New York of thousands of librarians around the country. What are you doing to get people who wouldn't normally be able to have access to the Internet to get people online?
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me. What I'm doing specifically is I manage a project called Libraries Online, which is a one-year initiative funded by the Microsoft Corporation and administered by the Public Library Association, which is a division of the ALA, or American Library Association. We're researching and developing innovative approaches for extending information technologies to underserved communities. So that's the main focus of this project, and it's a leadership pilot project for ALA that will share some of the best practices in trying to serve audiences of need.
The American Library Association and its director, Elizabeth Martinez, has repeatedly in the last few months raised this issue of access, especially in the poor or minority communities, to the Internet. I know that as of last year, only 20% of the library systems had computers and modems to connect to the Internet. This year, it's up to about 45%. What do you see as the social problem involved in the continued lack of access by certain sections of the society?
Well, I don't know that it's so much of a social problem as it is a funding problem. Libraries are absolutely the right place for computers to be placed. They put, as we're fond of saying here, the human face on cyberspace. They're one of the few places where you can get help from an expert in finding the precise information that you need. The issue really becomes, how do libraries get online? How do they face their local funding issues? And particularly in communities that are high-density urban areas or really remote rural areas, those issues of funding are problematic. And so that's the main issue for libraries. And in fact, ALA is actively involved in promoting an advocacy campaign that will build public awareness of and support of libraries as the public's actual ramp to the information superhighway. So that's what we're doing here at ALA to help address some of those funding concerns.
You know, it's interesting. On Monday, we're going to be joined by the head of the Media Access Project. And yesterday in Washington, D.C., a group of grassroots organizations were calling on the Clinton administration not to just give away the spectrum, the broadcast spectrum, to broadcasters so that they can go to high-definition digital television, but to auction it and to use that money, which is approximately at something like $40 billion, to put into public service or non-commercial communications, for example, like libraries' ability to give access. We're going to talk more about that on Monday and why the administration and why the Senate leaders are not asking for that auction, but in fact are going to give this incredible deal to broadcasters. But that kind of resource, would that make a difference in your work in libraries around
Absolutely.
The country?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's going to be some really interesting and creative ways that money is divvied up in the coming years, because information access through libraries is a very important part of how we view the future and how we view democracy.
Well, let me bring Jan Laurie Goldman into the conversation of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Once people get online, what about the issue of privacy? What happens to you when you get online and you start surfing the net, going from website to website?
Well, for the most part, what happens is that when you get onto the net and you start to surf the web, you essentially leave your privacy behind. Right now, most people have an illusion that when they're surfing the web, they have a certain amount of anonymity and that they're invisible. In fact, most of their mouse clickings, or what are called mouse droppings, there's a capacity to capture that information. The websites are essentially able to capture that information about how people are using the sites, whether they're looking at particular pages, the sites from which they've come.
So in essence, what you're saying is that there is even less security than there is, let's say, in a normal telephone conversation that you might be having, even though you are, in essence, using telephone lines, but that there are other parties, obviously, that are in the process as you're communicating.
Well, in some ways, a telephone isn't the greatest analogy in terms of helping people understand this. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat like if you go to a shopping mall and you go from store to store. Let's say you enter a bookstore or you enter a library or a bookmobile at a shopping mall. What is happening on the web is that those sites are able to know not only the categories of books and the stores that you've entered, but each page that you look at. Mm. And that is the kind of thing that when most people are in a store, even if they think they're being observed, they have a fair amount of protection. They feel a little bit insulated. They can move around without thinking that their every move is detected, is captured. On the web, the irony is that there's this tremendous illusion of anonymity, but it is absolutely not there.
Now, what's enabling the particular website or place you land to get that information?
Well, a variety of things, and I want to stress that some of the lack of privacy protection is not malicious, and it's not being that the web was not designed to erode people's privacy. However, that has been the effect. Browser technology, the way that content providers have set up sites, all allow for information to be captured. Some of that is being done because it has to be done for security of the system, for maintenance of the system. But more and more, as people are looking to make a profit from how people are using the web, it's being done with an eye towards a commercial advantage.
In other words, to be able to develop a profile of what are the likes and dislikes of every person who gets online for possible sales or commercial purposes later on.
Absolutely. And what we've been focusing on at CDT is trying to press policymakers and press the technology companies to start to build privacy protection into the technology. For instance, a browser could be constructed that would allow people to program a privacy preference in the minute they turn on their computer, just as easily as they do a number of other things, and that privacy preference could be communicated upstream to all the websites that they visit. So they could maintain anonymity if they want. They could give out information if they want. If they'd like to give out their email address or give out their age or any other information about themselves, they could do it, but only if they know they're doing it. The biggest problem right now is people don't know about the information, the personal information about them that's being captured. They have no ability to control it. And the price of using the web shouldn't be the loss of privacy.
Jan Lurie Goldman is with us from the Center for Democracy and Technology. Molly Callender is with us from the American Library Association. Jan Lurie Goldman, when you work, are you working with Netscape on this, which is most people's browsers, I suppose, and do they fight you?
I wouldn't say that we're working with Netscape on this, but we have been talking with them and talking with a number of other companies about how to program into the technology the ability for people to control the disclosure of information about themselves. Many companies say they care about privacy because they recognize that if people don't have trust and confidence in how their information is going to be handled, they're going to be reluctant to go to the web. And the minute people are reluctant to go to the web, then the ALA's stellar efforts to put libraries online and other kinds of efforts to encourage free speech and citizen participation and commercial opportunities, which many of these companies are interested in, will be thwarted. If people do not have trust and confidence in the technology, they're going to be reluctant to fully use it, I think, in the way that we believe the Internet holds out, particularly in terms of the democratic potential.
Why do you think there's been so little attention, let's say, in Congress or in legislative bodies to issues such as those that you're raising, while all the attention has been focused on pornography, for instance, on the net? That's the one that's grabbed all the media attention. Is there a reluctance to try to confront this, or is it just that policymakers really don't have a grasp of what's happening?
Well, let me say two things about that. I mean, what we saw last Congress with the Exxon Amendment, the Communications Decency Act, which was an attempt, a congressional effort to censor speech on the Internet, was really done with the intent of protecting children. Very popular issue, a very serious issue. How do we protect children from inappropriate material? Well, what we know is that there are technological ways to protect children. There are ways to filter out and block by parents, by libraries, by schools. We don't need a law that censors communication. And the Philadelphia court said that the communication on the Internet, the worldwide conversation, is entitled to the highest First Amendment protection. But in the privacy area, we've seen a slower focus. The FTC is engaged in a high-level privacy initiative. Representative Markey from Massachusetts just introduced a bill on privacy. I think slowly, as people are becoming concerned that free speech will not be fostered to the extent that we all hope it will be because of privacy concerns, people are now stepping up and saying, how are we going to protect privacy to make sure that we can foster free speech?
In fact, Molly Callender of the American Library Association, the ALA joined the Center for Democracy and Technology and some other groups in that Philadelphia suit. What do you have to gain from that in the library system?
Well, I think what we really want to do is really accent that libraries are safe places. They're safe places for children, and they're safe places for parents. They allow people to come in and use materials that are appropriate for their age and interest, and librarians have always been very actively involved in that. So any measures that we can take to accent that safety, we're interested in taking.
In terms of the issue of the information access gap, I'd like to get a sense from Ms. Goldman what your perspective is on the information access gap that is developing between some black and Latino and poorer white neighborhoods and the more well-to-do neighborhoods and groups in the country.
Well, I think it's not surprising that, you know, when we started out with access to the web, you have to have a modem. You have to have a computer, and these are expensive things. And so as we're seeing more and more that the cost of technology is coming down, there's money coming into the schools and the libraries, sometimes from the private sector, to wire lower-income communities. So I think that, you know, in a period of time, hopefully that gap is going to be narrowed. There's a lot of lip service, as many of you know, being paid to getting schools and libraries around the country wired, and in fact, some of that is really happening.
What are the percentages? Maybe Molly Callender can help us with this. I said earlier that Emerge magazine says in its latest issue that 30% of white households have computers, only 12% of black households, and only half of them have modems. Do you have figures on this for different groups?
You know, I don't, but I can tell you a couple of things that are sort of telling. I can tell you that families with incomes over $50,000 are 5 times more likely to have access to computers and 10 times more likely to have access to online services than other families. About fewer than 1 in 3 households overall owns a computer, and only about 10% own a modem required for online access. Again, as I said earlier, those living in rural areas and in central cities are the least likely to possess computers and modems. You can sort of begin to do the math on that. That's a broad sweep, but I think it gives you a sense of where people are.
And is there any congressional legislation that's out there now to help libraries help get underserved populations online?
It's in process, but unfortunately there's not any clear indication yet. And so we're really encouraging people to contact their local representatives and talk with them about what bills are in process.
Jen Laurie Goldman, I know that your group, the Center for Democracy and Technology, is pressing for a new national encryption policy that would free the Internet community to use privacy-protecting technologies. Where does President Clinton stand on this?
Well, the administration has been reluctant to eliminate export controls in this area and to allow for the free use of encryption software. We are hoping that they will change their position in this area.
Why do they feel that way? Why are they pushing?
Well, the administration has, for many, many years, not just under President Clinton, asserted that unlimited use of encryption could undermine law enforcement efforts, could lead to greater terrorist attacks, and that they need to be able to intercept and decrypt communications that may be used for illegal purposes.
And what is your response?
Well, our response is that that is not at all the case. And in fact, there was a report that came out recently that showed that that is exactly the opposite conclusion, which is that if anything, law enforcement is strengthened by the open and free use of strong encryption, not undermined.
How?
Well, what we need to see is that people should be able to protect their communications to the highest extent possible. And if people are going to be involved in illegal activity, they're going to do it regardless of whether the government has a limit on the level of encryption.
Hmm. You have a very interesting website at the Center for Democracy and Technology, one where people can see how much privacy we actually have. Can you describe it?
Well, what we did, we set up a privacy demonstration at our website, which anyone can get to at www.cdt.org/privacy. And the intent of doing that was to educate the public about the lack of privacy protection on the net. So for many people, when they come to that website, they will be personally greeted. It might say, hi, JLG, which are my initials and my email address. Thank you for coming to the Center for Democracy and Technology. We see that you use a Netscape browser. You're coming to us from the Washington, D.C. area. You've just linked to us from Pacifica's website. What we're trying to do is to show people that we, even a small organization with few resources, have the capacity to collect personal information. The other thing that we're doing at our site is putting online the policies, to the extent that they exist, of people who do business on the web. So right now we're focusing on the online services to show the extent to which they inform subscribers and members about how they're going to protect their privacy. Next, we're going to be looking at internet service providers to show whether and to what extent they protect people's privacy. But we want to educate people about the lack of privacy protection and also create a real demand in the market for technologies and policies that will really protect people's information and allow them to have control and empower them to be able to limit the extent to which people can know things about them.
Jen Laurie Goldman and Molly Callender, thank you very much for joining us. Jen Laurie Goldman of the Center for Democracy and Technology, Molly Callender of the American Library Association. And I should say our website is pacifica.org. pacifica.org. That's pacifica.org. For Juan Gonzalez, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!